Thank you for joining us. We're here today to talk with recently published authors in the 4Cs Studies in Writing and Rhetoric series. And today we're talking with Assistant Professor in the English Department at Hunter College, Dr. Lee Jones. Dr. Jones's research interests include rhetorical theory and criticism, composition, and nationalism. Today's conversation will focus on her recently published book, which looks at the development and performance of male identity according to the rhetorics and institutions that invoke American manhood. The title of Dr. Jones's book is From Boys to Men, Rhetorics of Emergent American Masculinity. Welcome, Lee. So, Lee.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yes. Can we start with maybe like an overview of your project? Can you give us sort of like the top side version, the top view of your project?
Sure. I think on the most basic level, From Boys to Men is my attempt to understand how and why hegemonic, that is mainstream, dominant, white, heterosexual masculinity has such power in the United States. So I try to do that by applying a rhetorical lens. I apply this lens to our cultural fascination with this transformation from boy to man that we see over and over again in so many places. It's this transformation that's been codified, mythologized, and ritualized in a lot of ways in the U.S. And my hope is that by looking at these sites, I will add to the conversation, the interdisciplinary conversation on masculinity, but within our field that I'll extend the scholarship on constitutive rhetoric, which comes from Kenneth Burke, and nationalist rhetoric within our field, to more localized sites. I can say a little bit more about that later. The book focuses specifically on youth organizations for boys, because I think these organizations are one place that we see rhetoric mediating the relationship between national discourses and the discourse of the home. So I see these youth organizations for boys as places where these grand national narratives get translated into home practice and language. So specifically, I look at the Boy Scouts of America, Sigma Chi fraternity, and the U.S. Army as three places where that mediate this relationship.
Fantastic. So looking at those three different, like, public national spaces. Can you describe like the origins of your project? Did it begin sort of as an interdisciplinary project where you're looking at like American history, advertising programs with the Army of One? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about like how the origins of your project?
To address the issue of interdisciplinarity, it was interdisciplinary from the beginning.
I see.
And in fact, that actually became an issue I had to resolve later on. But it started with my reading of Gail Biederman's Manliness and Civilization. And she's a literature scholar. I also drew at the same time from reading I had done in nationalism studies, which is very interdisciplinary, coming from literature, history, political science, and other fields. And so I didn't begin in rhetoric. It was the project was always interdisciplinary. In some ways, it became more interdisciplinary the more I read. And so the struggle for me throughout was this tension between the project as interdisciplinary and the project as a rhetorical project. Mm-hmm. And it became resolved over time as I rewrote the manuscript. And, you know, at a certain point, I sort of saw what I was doing in my field, which was to extend this conversation on constitutive rhetoric.
Can we talk a little bit more about the move from your dissertation to a book, mm-hmm. right? Because much of this, or a good portion of this book, comes from your dissertation, yes?
You know, it does, although I have to say the book bears a little resemblance to the dissertation. Yeah. It's a great question. It was a long, difficult process for me, taking the dissertation and making it into a book. And I would say the word revised doesn't quite get at it. I think I rewrote every element of the dissertation. I think it had to do with that issue I brought up of interdisciplinarity, which I think is a strength. I really had to figure out what I was saying to rhetoricians rather than to some sort of broad audience of people interested in nationalism studies or masculinity studies. And that wasn't resolved with the dissertation. Also, you know, with the dissertation, we write these dissertations for specific audiences, our committee members, effectively. I think in the end, we're really writing for these really specific audiences. Whereas a book is written for the field, and it requires a kind of authority that I didn't have in the dissertation. Mm-hmm. So I had to read quite a bit more after my dissertation. As I was creating the book, I had to read quite a bit more, and I had to think about what I wanted to say to people in my field. And so through the rewriting process, I had a writing group, which was just absolutely invaluable. It was a committed, supportive group of people that I met with for years as I was writing this. I also had a mentorship program that I took advantage of for a semester at CUNY, City University of New York. And then once I got to the point of sending out the manuscript, I got feedback from Victor Villanueva, the former editor of Studies in Writing and Rhetoric, and reviewers that all of that together really made the project for me. It gave me questions to answer. It pushed me in difficult directions. And I think that process of rethinking, basically rewriting the book, it transformed the project.
Okay. Can you tell me just like a little bit about like the writing group? Were these the other people in the group, were they also concerned with like, did they all have like similar concerns as yours in terms of like rhetorics of nationalism, mm-hmm. rhetorics of masculinity? Or was it?
We were kind of a motley crew. We all had certain overlaps in our background, but one of us was a literature professor. One of us was a linguistics professor, and another person was a composition scholar, but not really a rhetorician. So, you know, they were asking me questions about things that weren't clear. And I actually think that helped me quite a lot to have people who didn't have the same background I did to read my work.
Yeah, yeah. So as much as your project is an interdisciplinary project, your writing group is an interdisciplinary group of scholars as well, yes?
Yeah. And so that was, it really helped me. I also think once I got to the point of submitting the manuscript, having the feedback from reviewers in the field was crucial.
Yeah.
Because they could push things that I assumed I knew, they could push me on those. They could push me with questions about those things.
Can I ask you a question about reviewers too? Like, I know that in some instances, authors can suggest people to do reviews. Right? Was that the case in this instance?
I can't remember exactly. Think that I got lucky. I think that Victor Villanueva saw, of the reviewers he had to choose from, I think he saw that there were a couple who were really closely aligned with my scholarship. You know, their scholarship was closely aligned with mine. And I don't think I suggested the reviewers. I think he did.
Okay. So that was an editorial decision then.
Okay. Yeah.
Fantastic. Let's see. Can we talk about, like, I want to turn the conversation now to like future conversations on nationalist and masculine, like hegemonic masculine rhetorics. Like, how do you see the conversation on nationalism and masculinity being taken up in the field? How would you like to see it being taken up?
Well, I think, before my work, I think Maurice Charland's work on constitutive rhetoric is maybe the most pronounced scholarship, the most visible scholarship on rhetoric of nationalism. So he looks at the Québécois movement in Canada and the sovereignty movement as it was creating its constitution. And so in a very literal sense, in the same way that Burke looks at the U.S. Constitution, Charlene looks at the Quebec Constitution. And that was really a really important place for me to start thinking about constitutive rhetoric. Drew Lowe in our field has also done some work on constitutive rhetoric. But both of these authors have, their work has focused on constitutive rhetoric in the way that Burke conceived of it as a grand narrative within a national context. I think that there's a lot more work to be done on what Michael Billig calls banal nationalism. Mm-hmm. So to paraphrase him, it's not the passionate flag waving in the air, it's the flag that's hanging on the wall on the public building. There's the way that we imagine ourselves is affected through and through by nationalist rhetoric, although we don't always think of the U.S. Constitution when we think of our identities. I think there's a lot of mediation that happens along the way for that those grand narratives to get translated into our identities. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in our field on nationalist rhetoric in these more banal instances.
Billig's banal nationalism, I think you're right in that it isn't a very important concept, in that like it describes, or we can begin to become attuned to the way that we are in like our daily lives are immersed in a type of nationalism that comes, that is related to any number of like symbols that we are simply surrounded by on a daily basis, right? Like, that's such a fascinating idea. And I think you're right. I mean, because the banality of such symbols, they tend to go uncritiqued. Not only unnoticed, but uncritiqued as well, yeah?
And there's also another thing that's interesting to me is there's so much contradiction in these symbols and these different elements of our identity that draw upon national narratives. They don't always make sense when you look at them together. And those contradictions, I think, are important places for rhetoricians to look, because that's where there's possibility for transformation.
Yes, the possibility for transformation and individual agency as well. Yes, I mean, that's like the playground of agency, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fantastic. Let's see. So, like, I see like nationalist rhetoric and the rhetoric of like hegemonic masculinity. Like, if it's on one side of the coin, it seems to me like the other side of the coin is the identity of citizenship.
Yeah.
You know, or the identity of the citizen. And so, like, if we can turn conversation to, or this conversation to like, to local spaces, like education in general, but like local spaces of like the rhetoric and composition classroom, like what is the role, do you see, of the rhetoric and composition instructor to address like these issues, like in the lives of, and in order to make an impact on the lives of our students?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question and a really important one. I can just attempt to start to answer it here. But I think we've seen with this election last week that there's a residue of at least a century and a half of dominant white masculinity in this country, and it's always asserted itself most strongly as a response to fear. And I think that's what we're seeing happening again. And I think that our teaching can be an intervention in that rhetoric. I think that it's only an intervention, it's only a political intervention, rather, if we connect what we teach to our students' lives outside of the academy. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, I have this sample syllabus in the book, and I think that might be a starting place. I think it's important to listen to what our students have to say, to try to get a sense of their experiences of nationalism and masculinity, and to try to connect the reading in the course to those experiences and make those experiences part of the text of the course. So if we can do that, I think we can create courses that serve as some sort of political intervention. I also think, and as I was going back and looking at that sample syllabus, you know, especially given where we are right now politically in this country, I think I would add to that some scholarship on alternative masculinities. So I think I mentioned in that chapter Judith Halberstam's Female Masculinity. I would also probably add Martin Summers' Manliness and Its Discontents about middle-class Black masculinity.
Yeah, that's important, right? To be able to make adjustments to, like in your chapter 5, the chapter on nationalist syllabus, right? Like responding to the political time that we are in currently or that we're moving into.
Yeah. Right?
That's going to be very important as well. Speaking like as responding to the times, and moving forward, can you tell us a little bit about any of your current or next projects that are in the works?
Sure. The work that I'm doing right now is in its beginning stages, so it's not. I'm still sort of forming it out in my mind. Mm. But the reading I've done has helped me think about place-based identification. And that's where my interest is right now. And I'm specifically thinking about place-based identification among children of Vietnam War veterans, or the American veterans of the American War in Vietnam. I'm interested in how this type of place-based identification that I see repeated among children, narratives from children of Vietnam veterans, is working rhetorically, and how it's playing a part in public memory. We tend to understand wars as chronological. They begin at a certain time, they end at a certain time, and then once they've ended, then we begin publicly memorializing these wars. But I think that children of veterans especially understand that wars don't end at a particular time. They continue in the home, among other places, but I think the home is a really important place to look at that continuation of war. I also think that it's interesting that they talk of war in terms of place in a lot of the published narratives that I've read. Actually, I shouldn't say a lot because there aren't that many. The few published narratives I've read, they talk about place, but so often that place is Vietnam rather than the home. And so I want to try to understand that, how that place identification is working in the way that children of Vietnam veterans are thinking about memory of war and their own identities. And I want to understand what kind of possibilities we can open up for public memory of war and public memorializing of war if we rethink the role of children of veterans.
Fantastic. That sounds like a very interesting project. And something that's definitely worthwhile in terms of the U.S.'s history that goes on, the history of war that, well, has gone on as long as it has. So,
yeah.
And I think when we turn to the conversation about war to children, it speaks to like some of these foundational ideas about who we are as a people. And especially when you're talking about the children of that bring the children that bring together, like that are products in some way of these histories of warfare. The children of, you said the children of veterans, yes?
Yeah, there are a lot. Mm-hmm.
And then in some ways that like...
Yeah, the children of veterans. But
please.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Well, I'm also thinking of the children of refugees who've been, with the Vietnam War, especially refugees who've been relocated to the U.S.
Yes.
Because I think that's, I want to know how place is being treated in their narratives, if it's being treated differently, or if there is even this kind of strong place-based identification in their narratives.
Yeah, certainly. And how that place, how is the new places, like as they relocate, impacts identity, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At my previous institution, I was in Northern California, and there was a very strong local Hmong population.
Uh-huh.
And I was teaching the students of, like, they would have been like the children and the children of the children of the immigrants or the people who migrated from Vietnam during and after the war.
Uh-huh.
So what I saw there was a very strong local community, interrelated, like local community that depended very highly on each other, right? And I think that's probably similar to the way we see other communities, immigrant communities in the United States operate, right? Where there is a very like strong social cohesion. So that sounds fascinating.
I wonder about public memorializing of the Vietnam War, if we're not including the stories of these communities, like the Hmong community that you're talking about, the children of people who were affected by that war, then we're not really telling the entire story of the war. We're not memorializing a huge part of that war. Mm. So I want to understand how we can memorialize differently if we're doing it more inclusively.
Yeah. That's it, isn't it? I mean, it seems like, and it's a very complex thing, like when the United States goes to war in a country, that there would be survivors of that war that then in turn migrate to the United States.
I think
it represents a complexity about the narrative about the power of the United States and its military in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I wish you success with the project. It sounds very interesting.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's all for today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.